walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animals. Talking animals. Talking animal.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guests today are Catherine Michon and W. Bruce Cameron, screenwriters of the movie A Dog's Way Home, based on Cameron's novel, which opened nationwide on Friday. A core element of the film is breed-specific legislation, BSL. In this case, Denver's ban on pit bulls, and the story reflects the injustice and inconsistency of such laws and how they're enforced. Indeed, an overzealous animal control officer catches the dog, Bella, after she gets loose, cautioning the family that because he's deemed her a pit bull, the next time he finds her out of the house, she'll be euthanized. This sets in motion the central action of the movie. It's already clear from social media and other online chatter about the movie that BSL is not clearly understood, even by dog lovers. We'll hear about what precipitated the BSL element of the story, what impact they hope that this will have, and other aspects of A Dog's Way Home, including the remarkable story of Shelby, the canine star who portrays Bella, when I speak with Catherine Michon and Bruce Cameron in a few moments here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Later in the show, I'll speak with Dustin Jeffers, co-founder and head of operations for Saltwater Brewery in Delray Beach, Florida, which helped develop six-pack rings that instead of tangling seabirds or choking seals and sea turtles as regular plastic six rings do often, these are made of wheat and barley so they either biodegrade or serve as a snack for those very same critters. Also, 3 weeks from today, WNF's Winter Fun Drive starts, and on a very related note, I'm offering a pair of tickets this morning to see Trevor Noah this Sunday, January 20th at the Yuengling Center for a $100 pledge in support of Talking Animals and WMNF. If you're interested, email me during the show at dj@wmnf.org. And if you'd like to otherwise donate early on behalf of Talking Animals and me, I'd greatly appreciate it. You can also email me again this morning during the show at dj@wmnf.org, and we will sort out all those fabulous details. Right now, though, let's speak with Catherine and Bruce. By way of full disclosure, I should mention that when I was a talent manager many years ago, I represented Catherine, and the pair have donated to WNF in support of Talking Animals. That said, and with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9666, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Catherine Michon and Bruce Cameron back on Talking Animals. Good morning, Catherine and Bruce.
Good morning. I think if you want to give full disclosure, I'm the person who chased you out of show business.
Well, I've seen a reference there or two that you put on social media. I don't think that's quite right, but if you want to take some sort of backwards credit for that, be my guest. So
I'm always trying to take credit.
Yeah. Okay, well, there you go. That's part of the showbiz way. Anyways, congratulations on the movie. The film, as I noted, opened nationwide only a few days ago, Friday, and already seems to be a success on a bunch of levels. The box office sales for the weekend placed A Dog's Way Home third, just after Aquaman and The Upside. So,
yeah,
very cool. And while a film like this tends to be sort of review-proof, and Catherine, you've already stated your indifference to reviews of films you make, also on social media, this movie did receive some very positive reviews, including in Variety, which is a showbiz journal, is no pushover in film reviews. So, I mean, that said, a few critics did reflect some real ignorance, I thought, in their reviews about a key element of the story, and we'll come back to that. Some even taking to task the movie for implausible elements about BSL and deeming it outlandish. But anyway, since a key part of the film, and certainly a key part of our conversation this morning, is about breed-specific legislation, BSL, let's start on the remedial level. First of all, maybe you guys, one of you or both of you, could say what it is. What is BSL?
Breed-specific legislation, or as some people call it, BDL, for breed discrimination legislation, singles out a breed of dog as being particularly dangerous in comparison to other dogs, which is absurd. absurd, just a little personal observation here, but it's absolutely absurd to suppose that just because of a dog's breed, it is more dangerous. In fact, some of the misinformation that's out there is one website claims that the jaws of a pit bull are engineered to lock into place when they bite down, which is crazy because their jaws of a pit bull are like any other jaw of a dog. Pit bulls, by the way, are not actually a breed of dog. It's a classification of a dog. It's like saying hound dog, and therefore it encompasses a great many dogs, all of, a classification that can be used by some cities to euthanize dogs based on the idea that they might be dangerous. They're potentially dangerous. Now, of course, all dogs are potentially dangerous. If you carry this to its logical conclusion, we wouldn't have dogs.
I do think it's interesting to note that statistically speaking, you are more likely to be bitten by a dachshund than a so-called pit bull, and frankly, there's no dachshund bans anywhere, and furthermore, these bans don't actually work to do the thing that they want, which is to, you know, minimize dog aggression or dog bite.
Because, Bruce, obviously, the movie is based on the book that you wrote, and one of the other times we've spoken on the show was when the book, The Dog's Way Home, was out. And obviously you had done a fair amount of research then, and I'm sure you guys have done even more research directly or indirectly. Because there's so many myths and misconceptions. Bruce, you cited one about the jaw pressure and that they lock, and which of course is false. And you know, it is an interesting statistic to know that a dachshund, whatever, might be more pose more of a risk. There just nonetheless seems to be tremendous hysteria always surrounding pit bulls or pit bull like dogs. And again, no one can even quite agree what a pit bull even is or what it looks like.
Yeah, and I think part of the hype comes from the way that pit bulls are identified in the press. I've been following this now and noticing how if a dog bites somebody and somebody said it was a pit bull, that detail makes it into the story. Otherwise, it doesn't. If there's an altercation between neighbors and it makes it into sort of like a police blotter type of article in a local newspaper, if it was some other kind of dog, if it's an Airedale, whatever it is, they don't mention that. They only mention the breed if it's a pit bull, because that's just part of what's going on right now. This is a myth that's sort of self-perpetuating. Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry, no, I was just going to add to that. Worse, because of shows I've done over the years that are on or around this topic, and I've had people from major newspapers and others that have called in and said, not that they did it necessarily, but worse than what you're describing, Bruce, where if it's a pit bull, they say it's a pit bull. If it's not necessarily pit bull, they don't identify the dog. But worse, sometimes if there's just a dog bite incident, they just put that it's a pit bull just because the assumption is, well, somebody got bit by a dog, ergo it's a pit bull.
Well, if we're going to talk about your responsible people in the media, this will have to be a very long conversation, but you mentioned a review that I believe embarrassingly enough came from my hometown, Minneapolis, and then got syndicated and was in a paper in your area, where the guy said our film was implausible because he didn't seem to understand that the pit bull ban in Denver is real and dogs have been euthanized. And further, he's like, if that was a real thing, why wouldn't everybody just get together and write a petition to the city council? And it's like, my stepdaughter runs a rescue in Denver and has been working for a decade to try to get rid of this ban, which, by the way, has done nothing to decrease any kind of dog aggression, and furthermore, has actually had the unintended consequence of increasing the number of dogs that could be identified as pit bulls in Denver. People have kind of been like, oh yeah, you say I can't have a pit bull? I'm going to have a pit bull. You know, so
yeah.
They don't work, they're expensive, and as in the storyline of our movie, A Dog's Way Home, they can cause a lot of misery, you know, for people and dogs.
Yeah.
I love that you said that, Catherine, because the most important thing that just never gets mentioned is that stop focusing on the dog for a second, start focusing on the families. Picture how you'd feel if there's a knock on your door and someone takes your dog away and euthanizes it because of how it looks. That's what's happening in Denver and other cities that have this kind of legislation. the people are losing their pets, their dogs, and
who've done nothing. It's not like they get arrested for dog aggression. They just get arrested because we don't like the way the dog looks.
Yeah. Well, a couple things about that. One, back to the thing you pointed out, Catherine, that review, because it was syndicated, unfortunately, perhaps, not only appeared here in the Tampa Bay Times, but my mother-in-law said that it was also in the Palm Beach Post. And part of why that's important, I think, is that two of those places, especially the Palm Beach Post, are very close to where there's also breed-specific legislation, namely Miami-Dade County. And I mean, again, we don't want to get on too much of a tangent about what the obligations of critics are in writing about film, books, etc. But I do think if you don't know or understand how breed-specific legislation really works and that it does exist, if you dismiss it as outlandish in this review that we're talking about and others like it, I just don't know if you're living up to sort of a journalistic or a critic's code at that point.
Well, you're not. You're not. You're spreading disinformation. And you can like or not like our movie. That is the job of the critic.
Right.
But to say that something in the movie is factually inaccurate and then to not use the Google machine and see if, like, maybe it is a real thing seems, you know, it's, but you know, I again, talking about the press and them perhaps being slightly less than responsible in these modern times is, you know, a different conversation, maybe.
Right, but I do think, and this may be something that I actually tackle in some form, because I then, after I saw the one we're talking about, I saw one from Sarnia in Ontario, Canada, who went on a more extended jag about how, again, improbable this whole thing was. And I'm thinking, and this woman that wrote this review writes for whatever that publication is, the Sarnia Journal or whatever it might be, but also in a tagline I saw, reviews for a national television show in Canada. And she lives in Ontario, where, again, there's a provincial ban on pit bulls.
Yeah. It's so, just so ignorant. Yeah. And I have to say, you know, my stepdaughter, who I so admire, who is a Denver cop and also runs a rescue called Life is Better Rescue, kind of was living the plot line of A Dog's Way Home before Bruce even wrote the book. Because in a sense, what happened in Denver is they have like kind of an underground railroad where dogs that, you know, like in the situation in the movie, are under threat. We're kind of being taken out of the city. Now, in the movie, the people in the movie try to move so they can have their dog, but a lot of people just have to relinquish their pet and rehome it so it won't be killed.
Yeah. So, Bruce, I think we talked about this originally, but maybe we just go back to, and then to whatever extent this is crucial to writing the film. I mean, why was it because of your daughter's experiences, or why did BSL become a central element of the story of A Dog's Way Home when you were writing the book, and then obviously as the film is quite faithful to the book?
Well, as a novelist, I try to reach into the hearts of people and feel what they're feeling, because that's so important in stitching together a narrative that people will care about. I started contemplating what breed-specific legislation was like for the family, and realized that we're kind of missing the story if we focus just on the dog, because people who have a cold heart toward pit bulls are going to shrug and say, well, yeah, but there is a pit bull. I mean, I don't really care that much about pit bulls. In fact, I have an Amazon review from a woman who said, I bought this book thinking it was about a dog, but it's not. It's about a pit bull. So, I started thinking about how much pain it would cause me if my beloved pet, my gentle dog, was taken away from me for some reason that was completely bogus. And then I started further thinking about, now, what would that look like from the dog's perspective? And that's how A Dog's Way Home came to be. It's the story of a dog who is banished from her city because she's picked up once, so she's chipped, and if she gets picked up again, they will euthanize her.
Yeah.
And the dog is sent hundreds of miles away, all the way from Denver to Farmington, New Mexico. It's a temporary arrangement, but the dog doesn't know it's temporary.
Right.
So when she sees an opportunity, she escapes and she sets out to make her way back home. We've heard many stories like this. We know it's true. We know dogs can find their way home. Even across hundreds of miles and months, we've It's happened time and again, but we don't know why. We don't know how. I submit that it's because this dog loves her boy so much, her Lucas, that she can find him in the world, in the universe, and her heart and the invisible leash of love pulls her home across hundreds of miles in a couple of years.
Yeah. A couple of things. One is, well, since we're talking about what set that in motion, the breed-specific legislation in Denver, I think it's Denver Ordinance Section 8-55, Pitbull.
Very good.
Well, I try to do a little bit of homework now and again. But
movie critic.
Well, yeah. Well, again, I am going to come back to that because, again, as a former critic, not movie critic, but I do think there are certain obligations journalistically you have, whether you're saying I do or don't like this book or this movie or this album or this concert or whatever. But anyway, back to the law. Yeah, so Ordinance 8-55, Pitbull breeds, American Pitbull Terrier, American Staffordshire Terrier, or Staffordshire Bull Terrier are banned in the city and county of Denver. So that's kind of at the root of what incites kind of the action in A Dog's Way Home. And I guess I should let folks know who might just be tuning in. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you are just tuning in, my guests are Catherine Michon and Bruce Cameron, who wrote the screenplay for A Dog's Way Home based on Cameron's novel, and which opened nationwide Friday. A key element that we're talking about at the moment of the story is breed-specific legislation, BSL. In this case, Denver's ban on pit bulls. If you'd like to ask Catherine and or Bruce a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So I guess one of the things that, I mean, there's so many elements to this. I do think, and I've seen, as I mentioned in the sort of the opening, there's been already a lot of social media action about the movie, all kinds of other online chatter. And fittingly, I guess, there does seem to be questions and misunderstandings about breed-specific legislation, even from people who are big dog lovers. I mean, some folks really don't seem to understand this and therefore that element of the movie. I heard from a friend who lives in Florida and has had at least one pit bull who hasn't seen the movie yet, but she saw the trailer and was wondering why Bella, who doesn't look classically pit-like, apparently was being persecuted, which I think does bring us to an important part of the film and an important kind of fuzzy aspect of BSL. So, so let's talk a little bit about that, because Bella indeed doesn't, or Shelby who plays Bella, and we'll come back to Shelby's story at some point, does not look really classically like a pit. And so I think for people, go ahead. Yeah.
The truth is, she, just about any dog that you adopt from a shelter is part pit. Most rescue dogs are part pit. And the reason the cover of the original book had a dog that was like, I don't know what it is, and the reason Shelby's kind of, I don't know what it is because this law, there's no DNA test that's done. It literally only requires three ACOs, animal control officers, to say that a dog is a pit bull. But I do want to make a little side tangent to point out that it often happens in social media. It's like, oh, people are having a conversation about the movie. It doesn't look enough like a pit, or pits are terrible, or there's no such thing as breed-specific legislation. The majority of people really love this movie.
Oh, yeah. No, it's
like
gotten great.
8% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. We have an A- cinema score.
Yeah.
So, like, most people get it. It just seems that in this time, people love to be angry about something, you know?
Well,
or fight about something.
Right. Or things that are even slightly gray or fuzzy are absolutely befuddling to people. Because, again, I think for some of the basic responses that we're talking about, people say, well, okay, Bella/Shelby, to me, doesn't look like a pit. Now, if you do see the movie, and I don't think this is a huge spoiler, you see that Bella's mom, to me at least, does look more classically pit.
Yes,
but
she was actually a purebred white Staffordshire Terrier,
yeah,
I believe. So,
but
had the actress, the canine actress that lives.
Yes. She was only in her trailer at certain times, I guess. But see, I sort of feel like this all underscores the very difficulty of BSL to begin with, is that, as you've noted, Catherine, I mean, dogs that are deemed pits often don't look like pits. And years ago, I was at a conference, and this woman, I can't remember the name of the organization, but it definitely deals partly with pits and the perception of pits. And she did this kind of PowerPoint where she projected 15 or 20 images of dogs, and people had to say pit, not pit, pit, not pit. And most of us got them all wrong. There was a dog that looked like our yellow lab that, by at least her estimation, was mostly pit. So, yeah. I mean, it's...
Well, look, I mean, you know, everybody in America is getting their 23andMe and finding... People, I have friends that are like, I'm a Jew. It's like, wait, I'm African-American. Like, people are finding out that all of us can, you know, come from different origins. But my husband is a very tricky and clever writer. And, you know, the reason A Dog's Way Home resonates with people so much is not just the very clever way that the dog gets lost, which, by the way, the trailer of our film makes it look like she just runs out the window, and that's not the case. It's also this thing of it being from the dog's point of view. No one really in literature ever has written a true dog point of view book. Like, there are some books where the dog magically learns to speak English from watching TV, or there are movies like Homeward Bound, where the animals can speak to each other and their lips move. And it's like, no one ever tried to tell this story from a dog's point of view. And I think that's why people love A Dog's Way Home so much.
Yeah.
And I think that's why it's so great for this sort of side cause of getting people to understand the unfairness of breed-specific legislation, because you're seeing it from Bella's point of view. And, oh, it's tragic, you know, when she gets taken away. She doesn't understand what she's done wrong.
Right.
You know, it's very moving. We had an event last night to celebrate the people who rescued Shelby, who's our movie star that plays Bella.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was in a theater of 296 people, and they were laughing and they were crying. And, you know, everybody in that theater got a different and better view of why these breed laws are so silly.
Yeah. Well, I definitely want to come back to Shelby because she herself has a pretty remarkable story before stardom and I guess after. But let's get one caller involved, at least at the moment. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Catherine Michon and Bruce Cameron. Hello, it's you.
Is that me, Duncan?
Yes, please go ahead.
Hi, Duncan, it's Don. I just want to thank your guests for using this wonderful medium to show the silliness of BSL. Why we don't go after behavior instead of breeds is just beyond me. So I want to thank him very much for bringing this movie out.
Cool. Did you have a further question or comment, Don, or that's...
No, I just wanted to thank him.
Okay.
It's behavior that we need to go after, not... I mean, I've known more aggressive chihuahuas than I have pitties. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, great, Don. Thank you so much for your call.
Yeah, your thanks are grateful, indeed. And I need to be full disclosure here. Tucker is in the house. Our dog Tucker has joined the conversation. He feels very strongly about this as well, because Tucker, we did his DNA test, and he's got a little bit of everything in there. He's got poodle in there, and he doesn't look like a poodle. He's got golden in there. He maybe looks like a golden around the eyes. He's got beagle in there. He barks like a beagle. But I wouldn't call him a beagle or a poodle or a peagle or anything, because he's just one big mess of DNA that got all thrown together over several generations. He's our dog. We love him. And the idea that someone might say, well, you know, that's actually a pit bull, and take him away would be just the most devastating thing that I can imagine.
Yeah. Well, I'm certainly partial to peagles if they do exist, but
he's really been helpful in this conversation. He's sleeping, because he seems to feel, he doesn't seem to understand why we're on the radio.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Well, welcome, Tucker, to the conversation. We hope to get you involved, whether your lips move or not, at some point. But the film's obviously only been open less than a week. It's gotten all kinds of great response, generally all kinds of good, even reviews, not counting some of the ones we've touched on, great audience response. So it seems to have all the hallmarks of a successful film. In terms of the BSL part, And just from there, I mean, are there certain hopes that you guys came into the film with in terms of educational aspects or a discussion about these sorts of things that you felt likely that the film would spur?
I mean, look, with a movie, we're not making a political lecture. And I think I'm always the one that is left up to the brags. A Dog's Way Home is the number one family movie in America right now. beating out some competition that is a lot more expensive, like Mary Poppins and Bumblebee and Spider-Verse.
Yeah.
And, you know, so what we want is for you change hearts and minds by people having a feeling. If you think about, like, gay rights, somebody might have been like, oh, gay people are bad, and then they meet a couple, and they're like, well, my friends are gay. Oh, I guess it's fine. Gay people can get married. Like, that's how people's minds get changed. They don't tend to get changed by a polemic or some lecture or something. They get changed because they have a feeling. And A Dog's Way Home lets you feel what this crazy law does to a family, and specifically to a dog who is separated from her beloved human.
A couple of emails have come in. One says, the smaller a dog is, the more inferior their complex is, and the more they show their itty-bitty teeth. Big dogs are calm.
Well, I guess I would have, I mean, I appreciate the fact, as the author of A Dog's Way Home, I appreciate the fact that the person probably is giving a thumbs up to my view that breed discriminatory legislation is wrong, morally wrong. But I don't know that I agree with this particular characterization either. I've met certainly really aggressive little dogs, but to start making generalizations like this is what leads one down the path toward starting to lump dogs together, classifying them, and then banning them and punishing them for how they look. So in this case, it would be that dogs look smaller. I think his heart, your listeners, their heart is in the right place, but they don't recognize that this is just part of the symptoms. If you've got an aggressive dog, there's a way to train the aggressive nature out of them, and that's a good thing to do. Certainly a bigger dog is a scarier dog when they're aggressive, and I think that leaves, as Catherine was saying, that affects your heart. That leaves an emotional scar when you've been attacked by a big dog as to a small dog. I've been bitten by small dogs, and I was bitten by a big Airedale, and then the Airedale incident was scarier for me. But that doesn't mean that I think that Airedales are aggressive or should be banned. It just means that that particular Airedale bit me.
Right. Well, that's, and for years and years and years, that seemed to be the prevailing attitude, although over the many decades, there's always been sort of a bad dog or a dog that had a bad rap, and I guess it's been pit bull's turn for a longer stretch than some
right.
of its...
It used to be Dobermans.
Right.
Before that, it was Rottweilers.
Yeah.
It was German Shepherds. You know, people, it's almost like it's a fad, but in the movie, Alexander Schiff says, you know, it's basically racism for dogs.
Yeah.
And it is. It's like, you know, it's like saying Asians can't drive or something. And I was like, okay, that's you believe that, but that's a horrible thing to say, and you can't prove it.
Right.
It's wrong. So,
right.
Like, why would we extend that to another species, you know?
Right. Well, that's why, and as an alternative, as Bruce pointed out, to breed-specific legislation, the other phrase is breed-specific discrimination, because that's what this really does boil down to. And just as it would be racially or ethnically or otherwise, wouldn't be any more acceptable in those situations. But let's come back to Shelby, who I've noted, again, as you've noted, she portrays Bella, the star of the film. But she has quite a remarkable story herself. Let's talk a little bit about Bella, and starting with, I gather it was important to you guys that the dog that did portray Bella be a rescue. Why?
Well, I think we started off in the very beginning saying that the dog that is the star of the movie will have to be a rescue, because we're trying to prove something, and we're making a difference in the animals' lives, we think, when they are adopted, and we're trying to reveal to the world that rescue dogs are wonderful animals like all dogs. And
they can do anything. You know, we're really grateful to Sony because, you know, we did spend extra money to go and do a nationwide search and find a dog that had the temperament and the physical appearance to play this dog and to be trained to do the things the dog does in the film. I mean, she's on screen alone with no humans for about 2/3 of the movie. So, you know, our trainer, Teresa Miller, worked miracles that Shelby loved doing. She loved doing her work. In fact, she had a double dog, you know, sort of an understudy who sometimes would do some of her work, named Amber. And she, Shelby and Amber, were so jealous of each other when the other one got to be on camera. I was making jokes about it at the time. I'm like, wow, this is like a Betty Davis, Joan Crawford situation. Like, this is like an actress smackdown that's happening because these girls both want to be on camera. So,
and Amber, by the way, was also a rescue.
Yeah, they're both rescues.
Well, I guess there'll be some sort of FX miniseries about the feud between these two. But also, more seriously, what that reminds me of, Catherine, when you're talking about that is, I forget where I read this, and it might have even been more than one place. I'm pretty sure I read that anybody, or at least actors, and I think maybe crew, had like at least two phone numbers that they could call if they saw anything with the dogs that bothered them, that they thought was not right, or just anything that just was amiss or troublesome in any way. They had two phone numbers that they could call, which I guess would elicit immediate kind of response.
Yeah, there were actually three. You could call the studio, you could call the Humane Society, or you could call law enforcement. And you could be anonymous, or you could identify yourself.
And they also had two animal monitoring agencies on the set. We had American Humane, who's always done it, and there have been a lot of complaints about American Humane not being always the best at protecting animals on set. And then there's a new agency that's formed called the Animal Protection Agency that I think has much stricter and higher standards about the working rules for an animal on set. And so we're really proud to have been one of the first feature films to work with them as well.
Yeah, I mean, the point is that we had both, because if there's any doubts about either of them, you've got yourself covered because you've got both of them on set. And the whole point the entire time was that the welfare of the animals was the primal directive, primary directive. We had to absolutely make sure that the animals were not only safe but comfortable. And this is a movie shot a Dog's Way Home on the side of a mountain. Catherine and I were in this unheated tent with snow on the ground, and the temperatures were freezing, and I'm trying to type on my computer, and my fingers got stiff. And then I look over, and Shelby's got like three heaters and a sweater, and they're giving her massages, and she's drinking hot liquids, you know, and I'm like, why don't they treat the screenwriters as...
There's no screenwriters protection.
Right.
No one cared.
Yeah, Shelby's saying, hey, if you slip me a few bucks, I can maybe set you up somehow.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guests are Catherine Michon and Bruce Kamen, screenwriters of the new film, A Dog's Way Home. We're in our final moments, but we do invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. One of our emailers says, I too had breed preconceptions. I used to think Chihuahuas were hyper and barky. Now that we have one, I realize that was wrong. Our girl is mellow and sweet. Great topic. So
I love that.
So I guess as we are in our final moments, one thing I just wanted to note is that these dog books and now movies are clearly becoming a cottage industry. Those who've caught A Dog's Way Home saw a preview of A Dog's Journey, the sequel to A Dog's Purpose, apparently, and due to open in mid-May. So I guess one question is, will you keep developing this canine juggernaut? Are other books and movies around the corner?
I must say, it's the Bruce Kamen cinematic universe now. So, yes, we love telling these stories. We love making these movies. We are already in the process of working on two other films that will be coming out that are, again, you know, very dog-centric. Americans and the world really love their dogs. Why wouldn't we want more entertainment about that? I mean, there's plenty of superheroes.
Yeah. I gotcha. And with that in mind, curious what sort of reaction you guys had when you saw the response to the Netflix series Dogs when you knew your this new movie, Dog's Way Home, was released just around the corner. Did you feel like, wow, this feels even more like the right moment for this film?
Absolutely. Absolutely, because I mean, you know, I mean, I joke about superheroes, but for me, I don't know who's more of a superhero than my dog. You know, it's they sense our emotions. They can help us during the toughest times of our lives. They're loyal. They're loving. Like I'm personally endlessly fascinated to explore the relationships between dogs and humans. I think there's a lot of stories like A Dog's Way Home that are really worth telling.
Well, so let's kind of in a way circle back, because there have been films, there's obviously other films coming, and it sounds like a little hint that even more that we otherwise didn't know anything about are also on the horizon. But not all can probably have as important an element or issue as breed-specific legislation or discrimination. So what do you hope this film might achieve regarding that when more people have had a chance to see it again? We're less than a week into it being open, but is there something that you guys had talked about over coffee or in that cold tent while Shelby was warm or whatever about like, hey, if this really goes well, this might happen?
Well, we have a problem here. Of all the problems in the world with poverty and war and so many things that seem like they will just always be with us, the problem of hopeless abandoned pets can be fixed. We don't have to have this giant, expensive machine that is our animal welfare process of picking up animals and putting them in shelters and adopting them out, and that whole expensive, agonizing process to go away if people would just be responsible pet owners. Really important to keep in mind that spay and neutering is very much what a responsible pet owner does, and that alone could diminish and then even eliminate the need for animal shelters. So I would really like us all to consider that these animals, these wonderful animals, these dogs are thinking, feeling, sentient, even spiritual beings who depend on us to guide them through life. We bred them. We've made dachshunds, we made pit bulls, we've made Dobermans and all the rest of the breeds to serve us. And now most of them seem to be employed in the service of just being family members and loving us and supporting us. And as Catherine was saying, emotionally being there for us. All we owe them in return is to use our magic power of being able to guide their lives and just guide them toward the vet for a very painless operation. And then, boom, we have solved that problem for that particular animal of reproduction. Dogs are doing what people do. They're reproducing, and that's their nature. And if they've got a steady food supply, they will just keep reproducing. Well, we supply the food, but we should also supply the medical care to prevent the overpopulation of dogs, which leads to the tragic situations that we see all the time.
Well, that might be the perfect point at which to leave this conversation. So we've been speaking with Catherine Michon and Bruce Cameron, the writers of A Dog's Way Home, which, again, is a movie that's available at a theater near you, as they say. So Catherine and Bruce, thank you so much for joining us today again on Talking Animals, and good luck with the film. It's already off to a hell of a start, as we've noted.
Yeah, thank you
so much, Duncan.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye. In a few moments, I'll speak with Dustin Jeffers of the Saltwater Brewery, which helped create six-pack rings that degrade or are edible so they pose no threat to marine wildlife the way conventional plastic six-pack rings do. As a reminder, you can help yourself and me with a $100 pledge for tickets to see Trevor Noah, Comedy Central's Trevor Noah, this Sunday at Yuengling Center. $100 pledge. Send on your note to dj@wmnf.org if you'd like to snag that pair and help support WMNF and Talking Animals. Right now, though, it's time to step into the Comedy Corner. Making his debut in the Comedy Corner today is K. Trevor Wilson with part of a piece called Deer in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
Started backtracking to not miss my turn. I was going a little bit slower this time, and luckily I was going a little bit slower, because that's right when I almost hit the deer. And that is startling, to say the least. In an unrelated story, I can tell you how to get stains out of a rental car. It involves club soda and a lot of Febreze. You don't really need the Febreze, but I will recommend the Febreze. Yeah. That is such a startling thing when they dart out in front of you like that. And I consider deer to be very beautiful, very graceful creatures. But it's amazing how fast they turn into when they cut you off on the highway. I had never sworn at a deer before. I had never had cause to do that in my life. I cursed out a deer that night. I swore a strip up and down that animal. And I know deer don't speak English. I know that. But this deer looked like he got the point. He backed away from that exchange very sheepishly. Just, sorry, my bad. Family's over there, just trying to cross the road. And that whole interaction made me realize something, and it's that it is high time deer step it up and figure out cars. I feel like we have done quite a bit to prevent ourselves from hitting them. I think deer need to step it up a bit and pitch in, because cars aren't brand new anymore. They've had a few deer generations to get used to this concept. I think we need some old deer to sit down some young deer and lay it out for them. Be like, hey, you know those big metal animals with glowing eyes? Stop racing those. Stop it. And don't just stand there in the street staring at them. What are you, high? Get out of the road.
That was K. Trevor Wilson with a portion of a piece called Deer, taken from his CD, Sorry, a Canadian album. Now it's time to speak with Dustin Jeffers of the Saltwater Brewery about those special six-pack rings. This is Dustin Jeffers on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Dustin.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. First, maybe just give us a quick overview of what Saltwater Brewery is.
Yeah, so we started the brewery in December of 2013. We opened our doors, started serving beer. So when we first were coming up with the concept, the brewery, part of what we wanted to do was have more of a mission than just make good craft beer.
Mm-hmm.
And all the founders, we're all fishers, surfmen, surfers, just people that love the ocean, which is how we came to the name Saltwater Brewery.
Sure.
And instead of just being a beer brand, we wanted to be a little more. And using beer as a kind of like a tool to give back to ocean charities, raise awareness for our ocean organizations and environmental issues. We thought it'd be a great way to do that. People listen to you a little more if you give them a beer in their hand and sit down and talk to them versus just kind of preaching at them. And it's worked out for us. When we first started, we teamed with three charities, CCA, which is the Coastal Conservation Association, Surfrider, and Ocean Foundation. And while working with them, we added more and more organizations and charities along the way for the past 5 years.
Wow, well, that's cool. That sounds like a great operating principle, just fundamentally. And then lately in particular, there does seem to be greater awareness and concern about all the plastic in our oceans. And I mean, there's long been concern about the hazards posed by six-pack rings for seals eating them, turtles getting ensnared in them, et cetera, et cetera. So
the issues that we were talking about 5 years ago when we first started are definitely different than
So I'd be curious to know, how did Saltwater Brewery get started finding a safe alternative to the old-school plastic six-pack rings?
So while working with all these charities, we started getting known as kind of the company to go to with these issues. We tried to do as much as we could in the community. So We Believers, which is a marketing agency, came to us with this idea of a six-pack ring that's not made out of plastic. So from the beginning, we knew we wanted to use cans since we were focused on the beach and kind of that Florida lifestyle. Glass doesn't really do well. With that.
Sure.
We sponsored a lot of fishing tournaments and wanted to be near the beach. So glass on the boat is definitely no good.
Right.
So we knew we wanted to do cans. We were canning our product and using PackTech, which in our minds was the best alternative at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like 98% recycled material. There's not giant holes in it like the other rings, so it's harder for something to get caught in them.
Yeah.
And We Believers came to us with the idea of like kind of seaweed. And while Chris was talking to them, we were mashing out. So when you make beer, you use spent grain, or use malted grain, barley, wheat, to pull all the sugar that eventually turns the alcohol. When the brewing process is done, we pull all that spent grain out of our mash tun, put it into big bins, and send it off to farmers, and cattle eat it. They use it for extra food for cattle, kind of like a treat for them. So we asked kind of like why they wanted to use seaweed, and the idea was it's fibrous, and the grain is super fibrous as well. So they took some bags of it and started testing it out, and it worked pretty well. So that's how we came to the spent grain usage to make the six-pack rings.
That's great. It all seems very organic in both literal and figurative senses that the rings are made of wheat and barley. So just have another maybe a moment left here, Dustin. Are all your six-packs, all the cans that the brewery sells then, do they all have those rings that we're talking about on them?
Yes, they do.
Yeah.
So we started packaging with them in January of last year, like sending it out to market. We were happy with how it was holding up. And as of July of last year, all of our packaging and all of our distribution footprint switched to the six-pack ring.
That's
so we
great.
Kind of month by month to different distributors throughout the state, and we're on Carnival Cruise Line. We added them with them. And yeah, as of July, we're 100% plastic free.
And what do you see in terms of other breweries? Do you see them following suit? Are they already following suit? What's happening there?
Yeah, that's the goal. We've gotten huge amount of inquiries about it. So now that everyone feels like this is kind of product ready and it's held up to the abuse of distribution, which your cans do go through a lot, going from packaging at the brewery to our cooler to different docks to another person's cooler and then to a store shelf. Those six packs go through a lot of movement.
Right.
They've held up well, so now it's kind of ready to get a bunch of people on board.
That's great. Well, we are at this point, we're out of time, but Dustin, this sounds really great, and I really love this idea, and of course what I have posted and mentioned about it, people seem to be really enthusiastic about it and just think it's just fantastic. So this has been
just... If people are interested, they can go to our website and also go to e6pr.com. They're the ones creating the rings right now. So.
And your website is what, Dustin? Sorry.
Saltwaterbrewery.com.
Okay, that's simple enough. All right, we've been speaking with Dustin Jeffers of Saltwater Brewery, again in Delray Beach. Thank you so much, Dustin, for joining us, and thanks for coming up with this cool innovation to help all our sea critters. That's great.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. Bye.
Coming up at 11 on WNF, it's Rob Loy and Radioactivity, kicking off a three-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including in the noon hour, Midpoint with Nola Lay. Then at 1 p.m., John Gilmore presides over executive session. Then the music kicks back in at 2 p.m. with the All Souls edition of It's the Music. I'm not sure today who's subbing for Scott, but I'm sure it'll be somebody really good. And meanwhile, on this show, just want to mention one last time, we do have a pair of Trevor Noah tickets for a $100 pledge to support WNF and Talking Animals. The show is this Sunday, the 20th, January 20th, at the Yuengling Center. Again, a $100 pledge. You can just quickly email dj@wnf.org, and we'll get you all set up. Meanwhile, it's time for Name That Animal Tune, which is a giveaway, but please only participate if you haven't won something from us. In the last 90 days, there'll be a prize, a DVD copy of Blackfish, to the first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal song. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals, and there's been a lot of thinking about and remembering David Bowie recently, so I thought we'd get him involved in Name That Animal Tune today on WMNF. We'll be right back. Can you name that animal tune? If so, we will take your guess after the show is wrapped up, because we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Rob Loray is up next with Radioactivity. Next week, my guest will be Dr. Tony Frohoff, an ethologist and wildlife behavioral biologist who is the director of research for both Terramar Research and Sonar. She has researched and advocated for elephants and cetaceans for more than 30 years and has some interesting conclusions about where those species intersect. I invite you to join me for that conversation. I also invite you to visit talkinganimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast. iTunes podcasts are available there as well. There are also links to our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. And you can also subscribe to our e-newsletter there. So that's all found at talkinganimals.net. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa.